Committee will be in order. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Illinois.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, around the time Mr. Clark was pushing for the department to send the Georgia letter, the president and his supporters were pressuring the Justice Department to take other actions to change the outcome of the 2020 election. Mr. Engel, you were the head of the Office of Legal Counsel. Can you first off explain your role? What is that?
Sure. One of the Attorney General's most important responsibilities is to provide legal advice to the President and to the Executive Branch. As a practical matter, given the responsibilities of the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel exercises that that job on a day-to-day basis. And so, in addition, the head of OLC often functions as a general counsel, essentially, to the Attorney General, and so is often, you know, the chief legal advisor to the AG, as well as, you know, the White House and the Executive Branch more broadly.
So given that role, can you kind of describe your relationship with the President?
Well, you know, in connection with my role at OLC, over the course of my tenure there, there were a number of instances in which folks at the White House would seek to bring me in to provide legal advice to the President, sometimes discussing the legal options that could be pursued among various policies to reach various policy objectives, sometimes to advise the President that a course of action that they had been discussing was not legally available.
So I want to ask you about two things the President asked you and the Department to do. The first is reflected in this email that we're going to put on the screen. The President sent a draft lawsuit to be filed by the Department in the Supreme Court. He wanted you, Mr. Rosen, and Mr. Cipollone specifically to review it. You and the Department opposed filing it. We see on the screen here that the talking points that you actually drafted on that. So you stated that there is no legal basis to bring this lawsuit. Anyone who thinks otherwise simply doesn't know the law, much less the Supreme Court. Why was this the Department's position?
Well, I mean, I think that it was, you know, the memo sort of speaks to this, but essentially this was a draft lawsuit that apparently was prepared by people outside the Department. It would be styled as brought by the United States and by the acting Solicitor General as an original jurisdiction matter in the Supreme Court. It was a meritless lawsuit that was not something that the Department could or would bring. You know, somebody obviously prepared it, handed it to the President, and he forwarded it on for our review. But that memo explains why the Department of Justice, as Mr. Donahue said earlier, doesn't have any standing to bring such a lawsuit. The lawsuit would have been untimely. The states had chosen their electors. The electors had been certified. They'd cast their votes. They'd been sent to Washington, D.C. Neither Georgia nor any of the other states on December 28th or whenever this was in a position to change those votes. Essentially, the election had happened. The only thing that hadn't happened was the formal counting of the votes. And so obviously, you know, the person who drafted this lawsuit didn't really understand, in my view, you know, the law and or how the Supreme Court works or the Department of Justice. So it was just not something we were going to do. And the acting attorney general asked me to prepare a memo with talking points so that he could explain our reasons when he spoke with the President about this.
So would you say it was an unusual request?
Certainly. You said the request that the Department file a lawsuit from drafted by outside lawyers was certainly an unusual request.
There was another issue you were asked to look into. In mid-December, did the White House ask Attorney General Barr to consider whether a special counsel could be appointed to look into election fraud issues?
Yes. I think the President was probably vocal at the time that he believed that special counsel was something that should be considered to look into election fraud, and there is a specific, you know, request where the Attorney General sought my legal advice in the middle of December.
And what was your conclusion? What conclusion did you reach?
So this request was whether the Attorney General could appoint as a special counsel a state Attorney General to conduct an investigation. I mean, as a legal matter, under federal law, the Attorney General actually has fairly wide discretion to delegate prosecutorial authority, including to state prosecutors, which happens to assist the Department, you know, and not uncommonly. Obviously, a state Attorney General exercising prosecutorial authority on behalf of the Department of Justice would be fairly uncommon. When we looked at the issue, what we saw is actually that the state law, the state was Louisiana, that the state law precluded the Louisiana Attorney General from accepting any position, any official position on behalf of the United States government. So that answered the question that it was not legally available.
So during your time at the department, was there ever any basis to appoint a special counsel to investigate President Trump's election fraud claims?
Well, neither Attorney General Barr nor Acting Attorney General Rosen did appoint a special counsel. You would appoint a special counsel when the department, when there's a basis for an investigation and the department essentially has a conflict of interest. It's important to get someone who's independent outside the department to handle such an investigation. Neither Attorney General Barr nor Acting Attorney General Rosen ever believed that that was appropriate or necessary in this case.
In fact, Attorney General Barr had already told the president that there was no need for this special counsel. He actually stated that publicly, and we'll see that here in a video from December 21st.
To the extent that there's an investigation, I think that it's being handled responsibly and professionally currently within the department, and to this point, I have not seen a reason to appoint a special counsel, and I have no plan to do so before I leave.
So remember that December 21st was the same day President Trump met with Republican members at the White House to strategize about how to overturn the election while his attorney general is out telling the public, again, that there was no widespread evidence of election fraud. And yet, 2 days later, we have President Trump tweeting, again publicly pressuring the department to appoint a special counsel. He said, quote, "After seeing the massive voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, I disagree with anyone that thinks a strong, fast, and fair special counsel is not needed immediately. This was the most corrupt election in the history of our country, and it must be closely examined." The Select Committee's investigation revealed that President Trump went as far as to promise the job of special counsel to now discredited former Trump campaign lawyer Sidney Powell at a late night meeting on December 18th.
I know on Friday he had asked me to be a special counsel to address the election issues and to collect evidence, and he was extremely frustrated with the lack of, I would call it, law enforcement by any of the government agencies that are supposed to act to protect the rule of law in our republic.
So let's think here. What would a special counsel do? With only days to go until election certification, it wasn't to investigate anything. An investigation led by a special counsel would just create an illusion of legitimacy and provide fake cover for those who would want to object, including those who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. All of President Trump's plans for the Justice Department were being rebuffed by Mr. Rosen, Mr. Donahue, Mr. Engel, and others. The president became desperate entering into the new year with January 6th fast approaching. President Trump rushed back early from Mar-a-Lago on December 31st and called an emergency meeting with the department's leadership. Here's Mr. Donahue describing the last-minute meeting held at the White House on New Year's Eve.
The president was a little more agitated than he had been on the meeting, in the meeting on the 15th. He discussed a variety of election matters. He did say, "This sounds like the kind of thing that would warrant appointment of a special counsel." There was a point at which the president said something about, "Why don't you guys seize machines?"
Mr. Rosen, the president asked you to seize voting machines from state governments. What was your response to that request?
We had seen nothing improper with regard to the voting machines, and I told them that the real experts at that had been at DHS, and they had briefed us that they had looked at it and that there was nothing wrong with the voting machines. And so that was not something that was appropriate to do.
So there would be no factual basis to seize machines. Mr. Donahue,
I don't think there was legal authority either.
Yeah, Mr. Donahue, can you explain what the president did after he was told that the Justice Department would not seize voting machines?
The president was very agitated by the acting attorney general's response. And to the extent that machines and the technology was being discussed, the acting attorney general said that the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has expertise in machines and certifying them and making sure that the states are operating them properly. And since DHS had been mentioned, the president yelled out to his secretary, get Ken Cuccinelli on the phone. And she did in very short order. Mr. Cuccinelli was on the phone. He was the number two at DHS at the time. I was on the speakerphone. And the president essentially said, Ken, I'm sitting here with the acting attorney general. He just told me it's your job to seize machines, and you're not doing your job. And Mr. Cuccinelli responded.
Mr. Rosa, did you ever tell the president that the Department of Homeland Security could seize voting machines?
No, certainly not.
Mr. Donahue, during this meeting, did the president tell you that he would remove you and Mr. Rosen because you weren't declaring there was election fraud?
Toward the end of the meeting, the president, again, was getting very agitated, and he said, people tell me I should just get rid of both of you. I should just remove you and make a change in the leadership, put Jeff Clark in, maybe something will finally get done. And I responded, as I think I had earlier in the December 27th call, Mr. President, you should have the leadership that you want, but understand, the United States Justice Department functions on facts, evidence, and law, and those are not going to change. So you can have whatever leadership you want, but the department's position is not going to change.
The president's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, was also present. Do you remember what his position was?
Pat was very supportive. Pat Cipollone, throughout these conversations, was extremely supportive of the Justice Department. He was consistent. I think he had an impossible job at that point, but he did it well, and he always sided with the Justice Department in these discussions.
So let's pause for a second. It's New Year's Eve. President Trump is talking about seizing voting machines and making the same demands that had already been shot down by former Attorney General Barr on at least three occasions and by Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue on multiple other occasions. Claim after claim knocked down, but the president didn't care. The next day, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows sent a flurry of emails to you, Mr. Rosen, asking that the department look into a new set of allegations. We're going to put those emails here on the screen. Here we see three requests made on January 1st. One email is a request from Mr. Meadows to you, Mr. Rosen, to send Jeff Clark to Fulton County. What did you do with this request?
Well, really nothing. Certainly didn't send Mr. Clark to Fulton County, but that email was the first corroboration I had seen of Mr. Clark had told me at that point that the president was considering making the change by Monday, January 4th. So Mr. Meadows' email was something of a corroboration that there were discussions going on that I had been not been informed about by Mr. Clark or anybody else.
Interesting. The second request that you have is to have the Department of Justice lawyers investigate allegations of fraud related to New Mexico. Mr. Rosen, did you have concern about these emails?
Yes. Really two concerns about that one. One was that it was coming from a campaign or political party, and it was really not our role to function as an arm of any campaign for any party or any campaign. That wasn't our role, and that's part of why I had been unwilling to meet with Mr. Giuliani or any of the campaign people before. And the other part was, it was another one of these ones where lots of work had already been done, and I thought it was a rehash of things that had been debunked previously.
So the final email here included a completely baseless conspiracy theory that an Italian defense contractor uploaded software to a satellite that switched votes from Trump to Biden. The Select Committee investigation found that this wild, baseless conspiracy theory made it from the recesses of the internet to the highest echelons of our government. On December 31st, Mr. Meadows received this internet conspiracy theory from Representative Perry. On the screen now is the text that Representative Perry sent to Mr. Meadows, copying a YouTube link with the message, quote, why can't we just work with the Italian government? The next day, the president's chief of staff sent the YouTube link to Mr. Rosen, who forwarded it to Mr. Donahue. Mr. Donahue, did you watch this video?
I did, Congressman.
How long was the video?
Approximately 20 minutes.
Let's just take a look at an excerpt of that video, if we may.
What's being said out of Rome, out of Italy, is that this was done in the U.S. Embassy. That there was a certain State Department guy whose name I don't know yet. I guess this is probably going to come out in Italy at some point. And he was the mastermind, not the mastermind, but the anyway, the guy running the operation of changing the votes. And that he was doing this in conjunction with some support from MI6, the CIA, and this Leonardo group.
Mr. Donahue, what was your reaction when you watched that entire 20-minute video?
I emailed the acting attorney general, and I said pure insanity, which was my impression of the video, which was patently absurd.
Mr. Rosen, you were asked by Mr. Meadows to meet with Mr. Johnson, who is the person in that video. What was your reaction to that request?
So, ordinarily, I'd get an email like this, and there was no phone call. It would just, you know, come over the transom. But this one, he called me, Mr. Meadows, and asked me to meet with Mr. Johnson. And I told him this whole thing about Italy had been debunked, and that should be the end of that, and I certainly wasn't going to meet with this person. And he initially seemed to accept that. He said, you know, well, why won't you meet with him? I said, because if he has real evidence, which this video doesn't show, he can walk into an FBI field office anywhere in the United States. There's 55 of them. And he said, okay. But then he called me back a few minutes later and complained and said, I didn't tell you, but this fellow Johnson is working with Rudy Giuliani, and Mr. Giuliani is really offended that you think they have to go to a FBI field office. That's insulting. So couldn't you just have the FBI or you meet with these guys? And by then I was somewhat agitated and told them that there was no way on earth that I was going to do that. I wasn't going to meet with Mr. Johnson. I certainly wasn't going to meet with Mr. Giuliani. I'd made that clear repeatedly. And so that's the end of that. You know, don't raise this with me again. And so because Mr. Donahue and I had been exchanging our views about this, I think it was 7:13 on a Friday night of New Year's Day, I had run out of patience, and I sent the email that you're talking about, where I made pretty clear that I had no interest in doing anything further with this.
Just to button this up, Mr. Donahue, did you receive a follow-up call from a Department of Defense official about this conspiracy?
I did. I believe it was that same day.
Can you give details on that at all?
I received a telephone call from Kash Patel, who I know was a DOD official at that time, worked for, I believe, Acting Secretary of Defense Miller, and he didn't know much about it. He basically said, do you know anything about this Italy thing and what this is all about? And I informed him that the chief of staff had raised the issue with us in his office on December 29th, that we had looked into it a little bit. We had run the name that was provided to us by the chief of staff. I learned that that individual was in custody in Italy. He had been arrested for a cyber offense of some sort in Italy. The allegation was that he had been exfiltrating data from his company. He was either an employee or a contractor of that company, and he was in custody. That the whole thing was very, very murky at best, and the video was absurd, but that we the department, were not going to have anything to do with it, and DOD should make up its own mind as to what they're going to do. But I made it clear to him that I didn't think it was anything worth pursuing.
So you called the video absurd, and despite the absurdity of that conspiracy theory, we learned that Mr. Meadows discussed it frequently in the White House. And Mr. Meadows didn't let the matter go. The request went from the Department of Justice to the Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller. As you'll hear, Secretary Miller actually reached out to a high-ranking official based in Italy to follow up on this claim.
ask for him was, can you call out the defense attaché Rome and find out what the heck's going on, because I'm getting all these weird, crazy reports, and probably the guy on the ground knows more than anything.
The Select Committee confirmed that a call was actually placed by Secretary Miller to the attaché in Italy to investigate the claim that Italian satellites were switching votes from Trump to Biden. This is one of the best examples of the lengths to which the President Trump would go to stay in power, scouring the internet to support his conspiracy theories shown here, as he told Mr. Donahue in that December 27th call, quote, "You guys may not be following the internet the way I do." President Trump's efforts to this point had failed. Stonewalled by Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue, President Trump had only one option. He needed to make Clark acting attorney general. Mr. Rosen, during a January 2nd meeting with Mr. Clark, did you confront him again about his contact with the president? And if so, can you describe that?
So at this point, Mr. Clark had told us that the president had asked him to consider whether he would be willing to replace me, supposedly on a timetable by Monday, the 4th. And so I had told Mr. Clark I thought he was making a colossal error in judgment, but I also hoped to persuade him to be more rational and to understood what we had understood, that there's not a factual basis for the fraud assertions that are being made. So at this meeting, Mr. Donahue and I met with Mr. Clark, and I guess my hopes were disappointed in that Mr. Clark continued to express view that he thought there was fraud, even though he had not been a participant in the department's review of that, and that he was dissatisfied that we knew what we were doing. So, but he had acknowledged that he had had further, I don't know if it was meeting or phone calls or what, but further discussion with the president, despite having, you know, a week earlier said that if he wouldn't do that, and if he did, if he got an invitation to do that, he would let Rich Donahue or me know. So it was a contentious meeting where we were chastising him that he was insubordinate, he was out of line, he had not honored his own representations of what he would do, and he raised again that he thought that letter should go out, and we were not receptive to that.
Did he tell you in that the president had offered him the job of acting attorney general?
That was a day later. On the second, he said that the president had asked him to let him know if he'd be willing to take it. Subsequently, he told me that on Sunday the 3rd, he told me that the timeline had moved up and that the president had offered him the job and that he was accepting it.
Well, let's ask about that. What was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, on the one hand, I wasn't going to accept being fired by my subordinate, so I wanted to talk to the president directly. With regard to the reason for that is I wanted to try to convince the president not to go down the wrong path that Mr. Clark seemed to be advocating. And it wasn't about me. There's only 17 days left in the administration at that point. I would have been perfectly content to have either of the gentlemen on my left or right replace me if anybody wanted to do that. But I did not want for the Department of Justice to be put in a posture where it would be doing things that were not consistent with the truth, were not consistent with its own appropriate role, or were not consistent with the Constitution. So I did four things as soon as Mr. Clark left my office on that Sunday, the 3rd. Number one, I called Mark Meadows and said I need to see the president right away. And he was agreeable and set up a meeting for 6:15 that Sunday, so about 2 hours away. Two, I called Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, told him what was going on, and he said he would go into the White House to make sure he was at the meeting and he would be supporting the Justice Department's position as he had been doing consistently. Three, I called Steve Engel, who was, I was at the department, it was a Sunday, but there had been some reasons I needed to be there. Mr. Engel, I called at home and asked him if he would come in and go to the meeting, which he did. It proved to be quite helpful. And then number four, I asked Rich Donahue and Pat Hovakimian, who had previously been my chief of staff, to get the department's senior leadership on a call and let them know what was going on, and which they did. And then Eric Hirschman called me to tell me that he was going to go to the meeting and that he would be supporting the Department of Justice position as well. So I knew that the meeting was on course and that I would have a number of people supportive of the Department of Justice's approach and not supportive of Mr. Clark's approach.
Did Mr. Clark ask you to continue to stay at the department?
At that Sunday meeting, when he told me that he would be replacing me, he said that he had asked to see me alone, because usually he had met with me and Mr. Donahue, because he thought it would be appropriate, in light of what was happening, to at least offer me that I could stay on as his deputy. I thought that was preposterous. I told him that was nonsensical, and that there's no universe where I was going to do that, to stay on and support someone else doing things that were not consistent with what I thought should be done. So I didn't accept that offer, if I can put it that way.
And during that meeting, did Mr. Clark ask you to sign the Georgia letter?
That was on the Saturday meeting, January 2nd, that Mr. Donahue and I had with him. He again raised with both of us that he wanted us to, both, to sign that letter, actually.
So in that meeting, did Mr. Clark say he would turn down the president's offer if you reversed your position and signed the letter?
Yes.
Did Mr. Clark, so you still refused to sign and send that letter, I take it?
That's right. I think Mr. Donahue and I were both very consistent that there was no way we were going to sign that letter, and it didn't matter what Mr. Clark's proposition was in terms of his own activities. We were not going to sign that letter as long as we were in charge of the Justice Department.
Thank you for that, by the way. Mr. Donahue, were you expecting to have to attend a meeting at the White House on Sunday, January 3rd?
No. As the acting AG indicated, we had a meeting that afternoon that related to preparations for January 6th. So I was at the department, but I had no expectation of leaving the department. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I was there in civilian clothes, as we both were, and expected to have that meeting, do some other work, but I had no expectation of going to the White House that day.
So let's ask, so prior to that Oval Office meeting, did you set up a conference call with senior leadership at the department? And if so, tell us about that call.
Yes, so obviously it was a bit of a scramble that afternoon to prepare for the Oval Office meeting. We had discussed on several occasions, the acting attorney general and I, whether we should expand the circle of people who knew what was going on. It was very important that Steve Engel know, and that's why I reached out to Steve on December 28th, because if Mr. Rosen were removed from the seat and the president did not immediately appoint someone else to serve as attorney general, just by function of the department's chain of succession, Mr. Engel would be in the seat. We wanted to make sure he knew what was going on should that occur. So the three of us knew. We also brought Pat Hovakimian in, so the four of us knew. But no one else, aside from Jeff Clark, of course, knew what was going on until late that Sunday afternoon. We chose to keep a close hold because we didn't want to create concern or panic in the Justice Department leadership. But at this point, I asked the acting AG, what else can I do to help prepare for this meeting at the Oval Office? And he said, you and Pat should get the AAGs on the phone, and it's time to let them know what's going on. Let's find out what they may do if there's a change in leadership, because that will help inform the conversation at the Oval Office. Pat Hovakimian subsequently set up that meeting. We got most, not all, but most of the AAGs on the phone. We very quickly explained to them what the situation was. I told them, I don't need an answer from you right now. I don't need an answer in this phone call, but if you have an answer, I need it in the next few minutes. So call me, email me, text me, whatever it is, if you know what you would do if Jeff Clark is put in charge of the department. And immediately, Eric Dreiben, who was the AAG of the Civil Rights Division, said, I don't need to think about it. There's no way I'm staying. And then the other AAGs began to chime in turn, and all essentially said they would leave. They would resign en masse if the president made that change in the department leadership.
Incredible. I'd like to look at the assistant attorney generals on the screen. If we can pull that up, have their pictures. Did every assistant attorney general you spoke to, as you said, agree to resign?
Macon Delrahim was not on the call only because we had some difficulty reaching him. But yes, the other people on the screen were on the call and all without hesitation said that they would resign.
So as part of the Select Committee's investigation, we found that, well, Mr. Rosen, Mr. Donahue, and Mr. Engel were preparing for their meeting at the White House. Jeff Clark and the president were in constant communication beginning at 7 a.m. White House call logs obtained by the committee show that by 4:19 p.m. on January 3rd, the White House had already begun referring to Mr. Clark as the acting attorney general. As far as the White House was concerned, Mr. Clark was already at the top of the Justice Department. 2 hours later, DOJ leadership arrived at the White House. The Select Committee interviewed every person who was inside the room during this Sunday evening Oval Office meeting. Mr. Cipollone told the committee that he was, quote, unmistakably angry during the meeting, and that he, along with Eric Hirschman and Mr. Donahue, quote, forcefully challenged Mr. Clark to produce evidence of his election fraud theories. Mr. Rosen, can you describe how that meeting started?
Yes. So after some preliminaries, so Mr. Meadows had ushered us all in, and then he left. So Mr. Cipollone did some introductions and things. So after some preliminaries, the president turned to me, and he said, well, one thing we know is you, Rosen, you aren't going to do anything. You don't even agree with the claims of election fraud. And this other guy, at least, might do something. And then I said, well, Mr. President, you're right that I'm not going to allow the Justice Department to do anything to try to overturn the election. That's true. But the reason for that is because that's what's consistent with the facts and the law, and that's what's required under the Constitution. So that's the right answer and a good thing for the country, and therefore I submit it's the right thing for you, Mr. President. And that kicked off another 2 hours of discussion in which everyone in the room was in one way or another making different points, but supportive of my approach for the Justice Department and critical of Mr. Clark.
So at some point, Mr. Donahue comes in the room. Can you explain what led to him coming in the room?
I forgot about that. So initially, in part, I think, because he was underdressed, we had not yet told the president that he was going to come in. The White House had a list of who would be there that did include Mr. Engel and the White House counsel and the deputy White House counsel, Mr. Hirschman. We went in, and then we told the president, at, you know, maybe 10 minutes into the meeting or something, I forget how far in, that Mr. Donahue was outside, and he said, well, bring him in. And then Mr. Donahue came in and joined the meeting.
So, Mr. Donahue, you enter that room. Can you set the scene for us and describe the tone you walked into?
Yes, but if I could just back up one moment, Congressman, because you put the pictures up on the screen of the AAGs. I just want to make clear, one of the AAGs who was not on the screen was John Demers. John was the National Security Division AAG. John was on the call, but I preface the call by saying, John, we need you to stay in place. National security is too important. We need to minimize a disruption. Whether you resign is entirely up to you, obviously, and we'll respect your decision either way, but I'm asking you, please stay in place. And he did, so I don't want to leave the impression that he was not willing to resign.
Great.
Because
thank
I think
for,
he was.
Thank you for
so
that.
So with regard to entering the Oval Office, I was sitting in the hallway. An administrative assistant passed by. She asked me, are you supposed to be in this meeting with the president? I said, no, I'm simply here in case questions come up that other people don't have the answer to. And she walked away and then came back probably 30 seconds later and said, the president wants you in the meeting. I proceeded into the Oval Office. I took probably two or three steps in, and I stopped because I was, as the AG said, not exactly properly attired. I was wearing jeans and muddy boots and an Army T-shirt, and I never would arrive in the Oval Office this way. I said, Mr. President, I apologize. I'm sorry. I didn't know he was going to be here. And he said, no, 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 just come in, come in, come in. And so I went in. I attempted to take a seat on one of the couches that are behind the chairs arrayed in front of the president's desk. And he said, oh, no, 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 you're going to be up here. And everyone kind of laughed. And they moved the chairs a little bit. Someone from the White House counsel's office picked up a spare chair and put it directly in front of the president, and I took that seat.
Was there discussion about Mr. Clark? Can you kind of enlighten some of what that discussion was?
Yes. So the conversation at this point had moved beyond the specific allegations, whether it was State Farm Arena or Antrim County or Pennsylvania or whatever. We had discussed those repeatedly, and that was backdrop to the conversation. But the conversation at this point was really about whether the president should remove Jeff Rosen and replace him with Jeff Clark. And everyone in the room, I think, understood that that meant that letter would go out. So that was the focus. It was about a 2.5-hour meeting after I entered. And so there were discussions about the pros and cons of doing that. Early on, the president said, what do I have to lose? And it was actually a good opening because I said, Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. And I began to explain to him what he had to lose. And what the country had to lose and what the department had to lose. And this was not in anyone's best interest. That conversation went on for some time. Everyone essentially chimed in with their own thoughts, all of which were consistent about how damaging this would be to the country, to the department, to the administration, to him personally. And at some point, the conversation turned to whether Jeff Clark was even qualified, competent to run the Justice Department, which in my mind, he clearly was not. And it was a heated conversation. I thought it was useful to point out to the president that Jeff Clark simply didn't have the skills, the ability, and the experience to run the department. And so I said, Mr. President, you're talking about putting a man in that seat who has never tried a criminal case, who's never conducted a criminal investigation. He's telling you that he's going to take charge of the department, 115,000 employees, including the entire FBI, and turn the place on a dime and conduct nationwide criminal investigations that will produce results in a matter of days. It's impossible, it's absurd, it's not going to happen, and it's going to fail. He has never been in front of a trial jury, a grand jury. He's never even been to Chris Wray's office. I said at one point, if you walked into Chris Wray's office, one, would you know how to get there? And two, if you got there, would he even know who you are? And do you really think that the FBI is going to suddenly start following your orders? It's not going to happen. He's not competent. And that's the point at which Mr. Clark tried to defend himself by saying, well, I've been involved in very significant civil and environmental litigation. I've argued many appeals and appellate courts and things of that nature. And then I pointed out that, yes, he was an environmental lawyer, and I didn't think that was appropriate background to be running the United States Justice Department.
Did anybody in there support Mr. Clark?
No one.
Mr. Rosen, it was you he was going to replace. So what was your view about the president's plan to appoint Mr. Clark?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, the issue really wasn't about me. It would have been fine, as I said, to have had Rich Donahue replace me. I would have said, great, I get 17 days vacation or something. But the issue was the use of the Justice Department. And it's just so important that the Justice Department adhere to the facts and the law. That's what it's there to do. And that's what our constitutional role was. And so if the Justice Department gets out of the role that it's supposed to play, that's really bad for our country. And I don't know of a simpler way to say that. And when you damage our fundamental institutions, it's not easy to repair them. So I thought this was a really important issue to try to make sure that the Justice Department was able to stay on the right course.
Mr. Donahue, Did you eventually tell the president that mass resignations would occur if he installed Mr. Clark and what the consequences would be?
Yes. So this was in line with the president saying, what do I have to lose? Along those lines, he said, so suppose I do this. So suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. What would you do? And I said, Mr. President, I would resign immediately. I'm not working 1 minute for this guy, who I had just declared was completely incompetent. And so the president immediately turned to Mr. Engel, and he said, Steve, you wouldn't resign, would you? And he said, absolutely I would, Mr. President, you leave me no choice. And then I said, and we're not the only ones. No one cares if we resign. If Steve and I go, that's fine. It doesn't matter, but I'm telling you what's gonna happen. You're gonna lose your entire department leadership. Every single AAG will walk out on you. Your entire department leadership will walk out within hours. And I don't know what happens after that. I don't know what the United States attorneys are going to do. We have U.S. attorneys in districts across the country, and my guess would be that many of them would have resigned. And that would then have led to resignations across the department in Washington. And I said, Mr. President, within 24, 48, 72 hours, you could have hundreds and hundreds of resignations of the leadership of your entire Justice Department because of your actions. What's that going to say about you?
Wow. Mr. Engel, can you describe what your reaction was to that?
I think when the president, my recollection is that when the president turned to me and said, Steve, you wouldn't leave, would you? I said, Mr. President, I've been with you through four attorneys general, including two acting attorney general, but I couldn't be part of this. And then the other thing that I said was that, all anyone is going to sort of think about when they see this, no one is going to read this letter. All anyone is going to think is that you went through two attorneys general in 2 weeks until you found the environmental guy to sign this thing. And so the story is not going to be that the Department of Justice has found massive corruption that would have changed the results of the election. It's going to be the disaster of Jeff Clark. And I think at that point, Pat Cipollone said, yeah, this is a murder-suicide pact, this letter.
And yeah. I would note too, Congressman, that it was in this part of the conversation where Steve pointed out that Jeff Clark would be left leading a graveyard, and that comment clearly had an impact on the president. The leadership will be gone. Jeff Clark will be left leading a graveyard.
Again, the premise that, which as Mr. Donahue has said, but that Mr. Clark could come in and take over the Department of Justice and do something different was just an absurd premise. And all he was doing, Mr. Clark, by putting himself forward, was blowing himself up. And, you know, if the president were to have gone that course, it would have been a grievous error for the president as well.
Mr. Cipollone, the White House counsel, told the committee that Mr. Engel's response had a noticeable impact on the president, that this was a turning point in the conversation. Mr. Donahue, towards the end of this meeting, did the president ask you what was going to happen to Mr. Clark?
He did. When we finally got to the last 15 minutes of the meeting, the president's decision was apparent. He announced it. Jeff Clark tried to scrape his way back and asked the president to reconsider. The president doubled down, said, no, I've made my decision. That's it. We're not going to do it. And then he turned to me and said, so what happens to him now? Meaning Mr. Clark, and he understood that Mr. Clark reported to me. And I didn't initially understand the question. I said, Mr. President, and he said, are you going to fire him? And I said, I don't have the authority to fire him. He's a Senate-confirmed assistant attorney general. And he said, well, who has the authority to fire him? And I said, only you do, sir. And he said, well, I'm not going to fire him. I said, all right, well, then we should all go back to work.
Did you get a call from the president later that night?
I did, probably 90 minutes later or something like that.
What was that about?
The president, at this point, we left the White House, reconvened at the department. I left the department. I was back in my apartment. My cell phone rang. It was the president, and he had information about a truck supposedly full of shredded ballots in Georgia that was in the custody of an ICE agent whose name he had. I told him that ICE was part of Department of Homeland Security. I hadn't heard about this. If Department of Homeland Security needed our assistance, we of course would provide it, but it was really up to DHS to make a call if their agent was involved. And he said, fine, I understand. Can you just make sure that Ken, meaning Ken Cuccinelli, knows about this? I said, fine, I would pass that along to him. I eventually contacted Ken Cuccinelli later that evening, and I said, this is what the president told me. If you guys have anything you think should be brought to our attention, let me know. And he said, thank you, and that was it.
Mr. Cipollone left the meeting convinced the president would not appoint Mr. Clark, but he didn't think the president had actually accepted the truth about the election. Sure enough, all the same debunked theories appeared in his speech at the Ellipse 3 days later.
In the state of Arizona, over 36,000 ballots were illegally cast by non-citizens. 11,600 more ballots and votes were counted, more than there were actual voters. You see that? In Wisconsin, corrupt Democrat-run cities deployed more than 500 illegal, unmanned, unsecured drop boxes, which collected a minimum of 91,000 unlawful votes.
Mr. Donahue, Mr. Rosen, Mr. Engel, and others stopped President Trump's efforts, at least temporarily. Yet the message President Trump and his Republican allies pushed throughout December made its way to his supporters anyway. And they kept up the pressure campaign on the way to storming the Capitol on January 6th. Mr. Rosen, were you at the Department of Justice on January 6th?
Yes, I was there all day.
Once the Capitol was under attack, I understand that you communicated with fellow cabinet members and Capitol Hill leadership. Can you tell us who you spoke to?
Yeah, I was basically on the phone virtually nonstop all day. Some calls with our own DOJ folks, some with cabinet counterparts at DHS and Defense and the Interior, some with senior White House officials, and with a number of congressional leaders. I received calls from Speaker Pelosi, from Leader McCarthy, from Leader Schumer. I believe Leader McConnell's chief of staff called a number of other members of Congress as well. And the basic thrust of the calls with the members of Congress was there's a dire situation here, and can you help? And I reported to them that we were on a very urgent basis sending help from the department. We wound up sending over 500 agents and officers from FBI, ATF, and the U.S. Marshals to assist with restoring order at the Capitol. So had a number of calls. As I say, it was more or less nonstop all afternoon.
Did you speak to the vice president that day?
Yes, twice.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the first call was a one-on-one discussion, somewhat akin to the congressional leadership calls, updating him on what we were doing to assist. And the second call was a conference call around 7 o'clock with the vice president, congressional leaders, senior White House staff, some other cabinet officials to address that order appeared to be close to being restored, but security still being determined. And the question being, what time could the Congress reassemble? And the answer was 8 o'clock, and thankfully Congress did reassemble and complete its constitutional duty. There was one highlight of that second call with the Vice President, which is Mr. Donahue had gone to the rotunda of the Capitol to be able to give firsthand account and was able to tell the folks on the call, including the Vice President, that we thought 8 o'clock would work.
Did you speak to the president on January 6th?
No, I spoke to a number of senior White House officials, but not the president.
Mr. Donahue, on January 6th, we know from Mr. Rosen that you helped in the effort to reconvene the joint session, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
We see here in a video that we're gonna play now, you arriving with your security detail to help secure the Capitol. Mr. Donahue, 30 minutes after you arrived at the Capitol, did you lead a briefing for the Vice President?
I don't know exactly what the time frame was, but I did participate in the call and participate in briefing the Vice President as well as the congressional leadership that night, yes.
And where'd you conduct that call at?
I was in an office. I'm not entirely sure where it was. My detail found it because of the acoustics in the rotunda were such that it wasn't really conductive to having a call. So they found an office. We went to that office, and I believe I participated in two phone calls, one at 1800 and one at 1900 that night from that office.
What time did you actually end up leaving the Capitol?
I waited until the Senate was back in session, which I believe they were gaveled in a few minutes after 8 p.m. And once they were back in session and we were confident that the entire facility was secured and cleared, that there were no individuals hiding in closets or under desks, that there were no IEDs or other suspicious devices left behind, I left minutes later. I was probably gone by 8:30.
And Mr. Donahue, did you ever hear from President Trump that day?
No. Like the AAG, the acting AG, I spoke to Pat Cipollone and Mark Meadows and the vice president and the congressional leadership, but I never spoke to the president that day.
So in today's hearing, we've showcased the efforts of the Americans before us to stand up for democracy. Mr. Rosen, Mr. Donahue stayed steadfastly committed to the oath they take as officials in the Department of Justice. On January 6 itself, they assisted during the attack while our commander-in-chief stayed silent. Their bravery is a high moment in the sordid story of what led to January 6. My colleagues and I up here also take an oath. Some of them failed to uphold theirs and instead chose to spread the big lie. Days after the tragic events of January 6th, some of these same Republican members requested pardons in the waning days of the Trump administration. 5 days after the attack on the Capitol, Representative Mo Brooks sent the email on the screen now. As you see, he emailed the White House, quote, pursuant to a request from Matt Gaetz, requesting a pardon for Representative Gaetz, himself, and unnamed others. Witnesses told the Select Committee that the president considered offering pardons to a wide range of individuals connected to the president. Let's listen to some of that testimony.
And was Representative Gaetz requesting a pardon?
Believe so. The general tone was, we may get prosecuted because we were defensive of, you know, the president's positions on these things. The pardon that he was discussing, requesting, was as broad as you could describe. From the beginning, I remember he's from the beginning of time up until today, for any and all things. I think he mentioned Nixon, and I said Nixon's pardon was never nearly that broad.
And are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons?
I guess Mr. Gaetz and Mr. Brooks, I know, both advocated for there to be a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting and a handful of other members that weren't at the December 21st meeting as the preemptive pardons. Mr. Gaetz was personally pushing for a pardon, and he was doing so since early December. I'm not sure why. Mr. Gaetz had reached out to me to ask if he could have a meeting with Mr. Meadows about receiving a presidential pardon.
Did they all contact you?
Not all of them, but several of them did.
So you mentioned Mr. Gaetz, Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Biggs did. Mr. Jordan talked about congressional pardons, but he never asked me for one. It was more for an update on whether the White House is going to pardon members of Congress. Mr. Gomer asked for one as well.
Any
Mr. Perry asked for a pardon too. I'm sorry, I need to finish.
Mr. Perry, did he talk to you directly?
Yes, he did.
Did Marjorie Taylor Greene contact you?
No, she didn't contact me about it. I heard that she had asked White House Counsel Office for a pardon from Mr. Philbin, but I didn't frequently communicate with Ms. Greene.
Are you aware of any conversations or communications regarding the possibility of giving Congressman Matt Gaetz a pardon?
I know he had asked for it, but I don't know if he ever received one or what happened with it.
How do you know that Congressman Gaetz asked for a pardon?
He told me.
Tell us about that.
He told me he'd asked Meadows for a pardon.
Were you involved in or did you witness any conversations about the possibility of a blanket pardon for everyone involved in January 6th?
I had heard that mentioned, yeah.
Do you know whether the president had any conversations about potentially pardoning any family members?
I know he had hinted at a blanket pardon for the January 6th thing for anybody, but I think he had for all the staff and everyone involved, not with January 6th, but just before he left office, I know he had talked about that.
The only reason I know to ask for a pardon is because you think you've committed a crime. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
I want to thank our witnesses for joining us today. The members of the Select Committee may have additional questions for today's witnesses, and we ask that you respond expeditiously in writing to these questions. Without objection, members will be permitted 10 business days to submit statements for the record, including opening remarks and additional questions for the witnesses. Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentleman from Illinois for a closing statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Justice Department lawyers are not the president's personal lawyers. We count on them to be on the side of the law and to defend the best interest of the United States, not the best interest of any political campaign. That's how it's been since the department was founded soon after the Civil War. Justice Department lawyers are supposed to play it 100% straight. President Trump tried to erase his loss at the ballot box by parachuting an unqualified man into the top job at Justice. It was a power play to win at all costs with no regard for the will of the American people. It was about ignoring millions of votes. Ignore them, throw them out, label them fraudulent, corrupt, illegal, whatever. Facts were clearly just an inconvenience. From the Oval Office, President Trump urged others to bring his big lie to life. He begged, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. He didn't care what the department's investigations proved. What good were facts when they would only confirm his loss? And it's no surprise that all the far-out, fully fabricated, whack job conspiracy theories collapsed under even the slightest scrutiny. That insanity went from the internet to the highest levels of government in no time. The bottom line, the most senior leadership of the Justice Department, from Attorney General Bill Barr to Jeff Rosen, his successor and his deputy Rich Donahue, everyone except Jeff Clark, was telling President Trump the very same thing. The conspiracy theories were false. The allegation of a stolen election was a lie. The data left no room for doubt, nothing to question. And the Constitution left no room for President Trump to change the outcome of the election. But we're here today because the facts were irrelevant to President Trump. It was about protecting his very real power and very fragile ego, even if it required recklessly undermining our entire electoral system by wildly casting baseless doubt upon it. In short, he was willing to sacrifice our republic to prolong his presidency. I can imagine no more dishonorable act by a president. We owe a great debt of gratitude to these men you've heard from here today. Real leaders who stood for justice when it was in grave peril, who put their country first when the leader of the free world demanded otherwise. They threatened to resign rather than corrupt our democracy. And thanks largely to each of them, President Trump's coup failed. Contrast that to Jeff Clark, who would do exactly what the president wanted. Say there was massive fraud, forget the facts, and leave the rest to President Trump's congressional friends. Mr. Clark refused to cooperate with this committee. He pled the fifth over 125 times. Why risk self-incrimination? And President Trump's congressional friends, some of them are angling for pardons. They knew that every bit of what they did was a lie and it was wrong. That's all the more reason to respect those who came here to testify today. We thank them for their unflinching service in the face of incredible pressure. As it said, the only thing necessary for evil to succeed is good men to do nothing. Thankfully, there were good people in the Department of Justice. You heard from other good people too on Tuesday. They too defended us. But I'm still worried that not enough has changed to prevent this from happening again. The oath that we take has to mean something. It has to cut to the core of who we are and be the driving force of our service to this nation. We on this committee, we may be able to shine light on the darkness, but that is not enough. It's now up to every American, now and in the future, to stand for truth, to reject the lies, wherever we confront them, in our towns, in our capitals, in our friendships, in our families, and at the ballot box, and within our own minds and hearts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, for a closing statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I again want to thank the witnesses for being here today. After today, I suspect that there will be some who label you agents of the deep state or something else conspiratorial or nonsensical, meant to justify ignoring what you've said today, ignoring the facts. That may be the short-term cost of acting honorably and telling the truth, but your actions should have an important long-term impact. They will help keep us on the course set by the framers of our Constitution. Let me paraphrase the words of John Adams and others. Whether ours shall continue to be a government of laws and not of men is ultimately for the American people to decide. And let me also today make a broader statement to millions of Americans who put their trust in Donald Trump. In these hearings so far, you've heard from more than a dozen Republicans who've told you what actually happened in the weeks before January 6th. You will hear from more in the hearings to come. Several of them served Donald Trump and his administration, others in his campaign. Others have been conservative Republicans for their entire careers. It can be difficult to accept that President Trump abused your trust, that he deceived you. Many will invent excuses to ignore that fact. But that is a fact. I wish it weren't true, but it is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Again, I thank our witnesses and thank my colleagues for this hearing. As we conclude our fifth hearing in this series, I want to remind the American people of a few things the committee has shown. Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. Top Republican officials who supported Trump knew that he lost and told him he lost. Trump knew he lost. Those who say the election was affected by widespread voter fraud are lying. They were lying in 2020, they were lying in 2021, and indeed, they are lying today. Donald Trump went to court. That's the right any candidate seeking to challenge the outcome of an election must do. Donald Trump lost in court dozens and dozens of times. He lost in part because there was no evidence that voter fraud had any impact on the results of the election. To borrow a phrase from our witness earlier this week, Mr. Bowers, all he had was theories and no evidence. As I've said, if you're running for office in the United States, that's the end of the line. You accept the court's judgment, you concede the race, you respect the rule of law, and the will of the voters. But for Donald Trump, that wasn't the end of the line, not even close. The voters refused to keep him in office. The courts refused to keep him in office. But he continued to lie, and he went in search of anyone who would go along with his scheme. And we've shown today He pressured the Justice Department to act as an arm of his reelection campaign. He hoped law enforcement officials would give the appearance of legitimacy to his lies. So he and his allies had some veneer of credibility when they told the country that the election was stolen. Earlier this week, we showed how Donald Trump brought the weight of the presidency down on local and state officials who were trying to do their jobs and ultimately did. They investigated his claims and found them to be false. And then they endured Trump's pressure campaign at great risk to themselves and their loved ones. And of course, there was a scheme to get the former Vice President, Mike Pence, to violate the law and the Constitution by rejecting the Electoral College votes on January 6th and blocking the peaceful transfer of power. I mentioned the former Vice President last because, as we showed, when he refused to bow to the pressure in those critical moments on January 6th, there was a backup plan for stopping the transfer of power, the mob and their vile threats. Up to this point, we've shown the inner workings of what was essentially a political coup, an attempt to use the powers of the government from the local level all the way up to overturn the results of the election. Find me the votes, send fake electors, just say the election was corrupt. Along the way, we saw threats of violence. We saw what some people were willing to do. In the service of the nation, the Constitution? No. In service of Donald Trump. When the Select Committee continues this series of hearings, we're going to show how Donald Trump tapped into the threat of violence, how he summoned the mob to Washington, and how, after corruption and political pressure failed to keep Donald Trump in office, violence became the last option. Our investigation is ongoing. Those hearings have spurred an influx of new information that the committee and our investigators are working to assess. We are committed to presenting the American people with the most complete information possible. That will be our aim when we reconvene in the coming weeks. The chair, however, requests those in the hearing room remain seated until the Capitol Police have escorted members from the room. Without objection, the committee stands adjourned.